I have probably over the course of my career been too bearish. I don't necessarily mind that too much, in that there are plenty of people out there talking to my readers who have an incentive to be too bullish. But I do think perhaps I should have a health warning at the end of column saying, remember, it's always risky to be out of the market. You should be in stocks most of the time.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. If I said that in today's conversation, our guest is a classical singer who has performed in Carnegie Hall and in choirs for singers such as Cecilia Bartoli and Luciano Pavarotti, you might think that's a change of tune for the Money Maze podcast. If I said that he is a British financial commentator and author who spent almost three decades reporting at the Financial Times, including being global head of the Lex column, before moving to Bloomberg as senior markets editor and overseeing Points of Opinion, a highly regarded and consumed piece of daily research, you might know I'm talking to John Authors. So John, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. I'm very glad to be here.
I've followed you, I've read you for as many years as I can count or recall. You've actually been a centerpiece of lots of people in the markets for such a long time. The word iconic might be overused, but you've been with us on the journey as we try and make sense of some stuff we're going to discuss today. But very serious question. When you were at Oxford, I read that you were captain of your college university challenge team that earned the record for the highest score in any round of the competition with 520 points. And then you lost in the final. How did you feel?
Going straight to a weak point. In hindsight, going back over the years, the record was just so glorious and such a ridiculous one-off freak occurrence, like Bob Beamon's long jump record. We scored 520 and the previous record was 425. But to some extent, it did help that the opposition were very disheartened by the rehearsal and went to the Granada bar in between. I can live with it. It's one of my very happy memories of when I was younger, and there is something even more ludicrously emphatic about having scored the highest score ever than there would have been if we'd actually won the tournament. It's something I can happily live with. Certainly in the UK, it is generally regarded, this was whatever it was, 36 years ago now, those 25 minutes when we were always first on the buzzer and the other guys were giving up, still count for more than anything I've done since in the eyes of most people in the UK.
Fantastic. Look, you went from Oxford, you did a master's in journalism at Columbia Journalism School. You have an MBA from Columbia Business School. And I guess the first question that really got me as I looked at your history is, why financial journalism?
That's an interesting one. Journalism because I got ever more of a bug for curiosity. Financial journalism, to be honest, because it was the FT that felt the desire to give me a job, to take a chance on me. I did philosophy, politics, and economics, so I certainly did have some training in economics. I was much more interested at that point in politics. My first breakthrough into journalism was actually with the Daily Telegraph on American politics. I had spent time at an organization called Congressional Quarterly, which I think has now been subsumed into something else, but I had spent a long summer in Washington phoning up state parties about how they were going to be running their caucuses and primaries the following year. So deep in the weeds of what was going to happen in American politics. And I managed to parlay that into getting the arrogance of youth, or you're so young, you don't know what you don't know. I said to the Telegraph, can I help out, please? And they said, yes. So journalism was a bug that came on quite early. Financial journalism, the FT very kindly decided they wanted to hire me. And since then, it's a glove that has steadily fit better. And once you begin to get, most people enjoy doing things they're good at. And most people enjoy doing things that others recognize them to be good at, which largely speaking is where I am with what I've been doing as a financial columnist for the last almost 20 years now. It's come to fit better, but I think it's part of one of the things I'm actually quite lucky with when it comes to being a financial columnist is that I didn't set out as being fascinated by markets or terribly excited to try to go away and make money. I still think of myself more as a journalist trying to understand what's going on and explain it rather than somebody who is really fascinated by this and wants to show you how to make more money than anyone else.
That is interesting. I think we're going to weave a little bit into the journalism and a little bit into the markets here because you sit firmly, squarely. People who are professional money managers are consuming your work every day. Clearly, you've validated what you've been doing. But in the 29 years at the FT, if I'm right, you held this position such as US markets editor, Mexico Bureau city chief, US banking correspondent, 2010 head of the Lex column. As you reflect back, what was the most satisfying piece of work?
Possibly, and this surprises people, well, there are two things. First of all, the crisis. I think I made the joke at the time. One of my favorite quotes is George Harrison apparently once said, if you're going to play guitar in a rock band, it might as well be the Beatles. And by the same token, if you're going to be an investment editor, if you're going to be a financial columnist, it might as well be for the Financial Times in New York from 2006 to 2009 during that whole period of the crisis. That was a very great honor in many ways. And you want to be challenged. I was. And it still feels very good to have done that, to have had that opportunity and to have taken it. In terms of what was most satisfying, I loved going to Mexico, which was a very unorthodox thing when I did it. I'd already got my MBA and I'd spent 3 years being the banking correspondent and doing a lot of stuff in Wall Street at a very exciting time in the dot-com bubble. But I was still young enough to not be in too much of a hurry. And I went off to Mexico, which was very good for me in terms of having to learn Spanish. But it was fascinating. It's a wonderful country. I got married while I was there. We had our first kid while we were there. So it's obviously lots of very positive connections for me. But the power and the opportunity to make a difference you have as a foreign correspondent in a country where a lot of the domestic correspondents have quite strong limitations on what they can say. And when they really care what the foreign press says about them, that matters a lot. That was a real sense of being able to do something. And I think the other thing that's interesting, it's very useful to go outside your box occasionally and understand what really makes something tick. The anecdote, if there was one experience that really helped me understand what was going wrong during the great financial crisis, and understand the mechanics of what the problem was. When I was in Mexico, they were still just completing their recovery from the big banking crisis. And one big thing the government wanted to do was get more mortgage finance out there so that the middle class could actually afford to buy houses again. So they appointed this extremely bright young technocrat with an economics doctorate from MIT who spoke English better than I did to set up this body and work out how they were going to funds prime the mortgage market. And the basic idea was he was going to go away and work out how to set up a Mexican Fannie Mae. And I interviewed this guy, very calm, very clear. He came back from months of fact-finding in the US and said, the last thing on earth Mexico needs is its own Fannie Mae. And he then explained what the problems were with Fannie Mae in ways that now seem completely obvious because everything he's worried about came to pass. And the other thing that was very interesting, he said, the one thing we do need to do in this country if we're going to get the mortgage market going is we need to get credit insurance. You need to get monoline insurers involved so that it's possible to securitize this at all, so that people outside the industry are going to be prepared to buy mortgages. And indeed, the monoline insurers in the US had AAA ratings. And when they all went bust early in 2008, that was a very serious problem. It was Bill Ackman's very famous short. For initial short was on the monoline insurance. You wouldn't think it, but perhaps the single most revealing moment that guided me through the global financial crisis was talking with a young technocrat trying to rebuild Mexico after its banking crisis.
Which makes me make three observations. Number one, Bill Ackman is, we hope, appearing in a couple of months' time, so we're looking forward to that. Number two, I am old enough, and I was on a call yesterday listening to the case for Venezuelan debt and restructurings to remember buying the CETES in 94 when I was doing a little bit of fiddling around as an investor. And the third thing, which we often ask at the end, but I have to ask you right now, is if you were advising a young person as to which geography they should start their journalistic career in finance, where would you tell them to go?
I think time in emerging markets. First of all, I have lots of younger, it's one of the more pleasant parts of my job is that they asked me at Bloomberg and they did at the FT to mentor younger journalists, which is a very rewarding, pleasant thing to do. They all think that a year is a long time because they're younger. I think I used to think that too. Telling people you don't need to be in too much of a hurry and to take the opportunity to actually understand an emerging market before moving on. I think a lot of the best journalists I've known, both Bloomberg and the FT, were people who did spend a good solid few years in slightly more funky, out-of-the-way places. China is a very difficult place to cover these days. Latin America, Spanish and Portuguese are that much easier to conquer. That's a pretty interesting concept. I think the whole of India, the Indian subcontinent, is undercovered and seriously fascinating place. But it's when you work in places where you can't rely on institutions to work, or when those institutions don't exist, but you understand how important they are and you have a better grasp of how things like 2008 happened, how that went as badly wrong as it did. Go to the emerging markets, young man and young woman.
Great. So that takes us back. I'm going to come back to the Great Financial Crisis because in 2010, you publish The Fearful Rise of Markets, A Short View of Global Bubbles and Synchronized Meltdown. And one of your conclusions, which was, of course, related to the Greenspan put that we started, I guess, all the way back in Y2K in 99, it led to artificially high levels of price correlation. And my question is, has anything happened to diminish that?
On the specifics of the correlation, yes. On the perverse impact of what you might call the Greenspan put, whatever you want to call it, the prolonged intervention to keep yields low, which was, as it turns out, only in its infancy when I wrote that book, that continues in a very big way. Some of the correlations you see, it's, a lot of this is to do with the changing role of China, but China no longer can be guaranteed to raise the entire complex of other emerging markets and of commodities in the way that it once did. And you see some very startling carry trading going on at the moment. But similarly, at one point, the lower the VIX, the lower volatility in the US stock market, the stronger the Brazilian real would be. It was a very clear relationship. The Hungarian stock market tracked almost perfectly with the Korean. I had a lot of fun finding all these examples back in the day. The extremity of the way the world behaves as one has diminished, I would say. That said, if you look inside individual markets, and particularly stock markets, the growth of passive investing, the growth of ETFs has definitely led to, there is much more need for top-down analysis these days rather than classic Lex style, looking at companies and working out whether they're too cheap or too expensive. So much is now happening from top-down decisions, which are reflected through ETFs and can have very extreme, strange effects when they finally reach the level of individual stocks and bonds.
And before we leave that, would therefore the conclusion that I could take from your observation be that whilst global macro hedge funds have largely been out of favor for 20 years, is that you would want to be, if you're an allocator, thinking, looking, exploring them more?
I think you have to be. That said, it's very difficult. The ways to actually try to make money to do better than a 60-40 portfolio, it is very difficult to do that. Even though there are many problems with the 60-40 portfolio, it is very difficult to do that. One is to have the guts to be a concentrated stock picker, only buy stocks where you're really confident that they're going to go up a lot because everyone else has it wrong. And another, yes, is to really try to fly ahead of the macro, work out what you know that others aren't getting about the macro. Also, not exactly easy. And I guess the same is also true with stock timing, I've learned, is a very serious impediment, both to stock pickers and to macro asset allocators.
I'm going to fortunately be able to pose that question to Scott Bessent in a few weeks, who, of course, was Soros' CIO. And he says he really likes to focus on the one or two big macro trades that could run for a while. So I'm hoping to be enlightened.
And if you're George Soros, you have the confidence to do so. It's very few of us actually have the testicular fortitude to do the kind of things that George Soros has done over the years.
We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. There are 10 million casks of fine whiskey in Speyside, and we know just the people to help you find the right one. We're delighted that Bordeaux Index, the world's leading fine wine merchant and whiskey merchant, has continued to be a supportive sponsor over the last year. Their team of whiskey, investment, and trading experts work diligently to curate a selection of whiskey with outstanding potential, making collecting and investing in whiskey a rewarding and exciting experience. Whether you're looking to find an exclusive bottle for your collection, or if you'd like to start investing in this liquid asset, Bordeaux Index is the only place to start your journey. Discover more at bordeauxindex.com. So before we get to that 60-40, in 2018, you wrote a really good piece, The Investing Lessons from 12 Years of Writing the Long View, and you had some really important takeaways. Can you just summarize them? And also, would you add or subtract any today?
I don't think I would subtract any. That was my final long view for the FT. And I looked at how a mutual fund that I had bought with the proceeds of a prize 26 years earlier for being Unit Trust Journalist of the Year, how that had done. And basically, it hadn't done that badly at all. In fact, it had more or less matched the FTSE, and compound interest meant that it was worth a lot of money. The big thing, and I think this is the critical point, is that if I had been more diversified and hadn't focused only on the UK, which I did, I would have made vastly more money, because the US, which is not exactly a high-risk place to place your money if you're a Brit, did vastly better than the UK did. So that's one key element, is you do need to stay diversified. Another one, I think, is that timing is ultimately close to impossible. So if it's your own money, go with the discipline of rebalancing. You will at least, therefore, be selling stuff that has recently risen a bit and putting more money into stuff that might be relatively cheaper. And that's a good, clear discipline. You're not going to buy on March the 9th, 2009. You're not going to take all your money out of cash and put them into stocks just when the S&P hit 666. That's just not going to happen. If you continue to do dollar cost averaging, if you continue to rebase every 3 months or so, along the way, you're going to buy some stuff cheaper. And that's about as much as you can hope for. I also think that, like with what I was just saying, markets aren't efficient, but they're efficient enough that it's almost impossible for a human being to be confident they can beat the markets. So I do think, despite all the problems I'm concerned about with passive investing, you have to put passive investments at the core of any portfolio. Another point that I will admit that I have probably over the course of my career been too bearish. I don't necessarily mind that too much, in that there are plenty of people out there talking to my readers who have an incentive to be too bullish. But I do think perhaps I should have a health warning at the end of column saying, remember, it's always risky to be out of the market. You should be in stocks most of the time. So that doesn't mean that I'm comfortable with pipe that a lot of other people get, but there is a risk involved, an opportunity cost involved in not being in the stock market. And even when I'm being fairly negative about the stock market, I don't think you should be out altogether. That even in 2008, kept some money in, at least it was there when it hit bottom. I suppose the final thing from what I wrote then, which I certainly still agree with, is that many things are more important in life than finance. And very few of us can not worry about money at all, such as life. But you can automate, you can just give yourself a clear enough structure and get it working following some fairly straightforward rules, so that you worry about money that much less and get on to enjoy the things in life that are truly enjoyable. I had a fascinating time writing about the markets the last 15, 20 years compared to the various good times that have come along, bringing up kids and so on. That's what matters.
So that leads us to the 60-40. 60 equity, 40 debts, cornerstones of long-term portfolios. Then we move into an extraordinary era that none of us of a certain age could have predicted, where super cheap money becomes the norm and alternatives and the industry surrounding it mushroom. I had a question from a gentleman called Hugo Cable-Cure, who works at Rothschilds in London. And he said, can you make the case that certain alternatives can replicate the risk-adjusted returns of bonds despite their illiquidity?
I have friends who've made exactly that case. There's the idea that hedge funds, you can just take a look at the standard deviation. You can work out how volatile they are and what their returns are, what they're correlated with, and then you can just buy futures to mimic even George Soros' quantum fund. In terms of liquidity, mimicking what you can do with a 60-40, one of the people who most impressed me that I've come across, been lucky enough to meet, was David Swensen, who ran the Yale Endowment for many years and passed away from cancer last year, very sadly. And I think he's a genius in many ways. And his genius was to spot the opportunities of investing in illiquid assets to efficient public markets, difficult to beat, inefficient ones you can beat. He has Yale's assets tied up in things like forestry, private equity, hedge funds. The man's impact is immense. My wife went to Yale. When she goes on reunions with her friends, they just can't believe what's happened to the physical stock of the campus. It's a vastly richer place, and it shows, and it makes a difference. That said, in 2008, he actually needed to borrow money because he was so illiquid that he wasn't actually able. There are a certain amount, proportion of an endowment that has to be paid out each year, and he wasn't able to do that without borrowing. And a number of other big endowment funds found themselves in the same position. For conflict of interest reasons, I don't invest. I don't do any active investing myself at all. The one share, individual share I have, my coffee cup is actually a coffee cup for Lewis Football Club, where I was brought up in Lewis, and they have a community share scheme. So I am a shareholder in Lewis FC. If I make a penny out of it, I will be flabbergasted, and I might even be angry with the club. So anyway, I avoid doing those investments, and I think that's necessary. I do sit pro bono on the investment committee of the endowment of my old college, and that has been a fascinating experience. It's a very useful experience, and one of the things is that it's taught me the importance of liquidity. Even if you are a 700-year-old Oxford college wanting to make investments for the very long-term future, you do actually need to be able to get at the money and to be confident that you can get at the money. And actually looking at the terms under which you can get into some of these longer-term investments at an institutional level, it's quite useful for me that I get to see how the investment banks pitch themselves to potential clients rather than to journalists this way. I think it probably is possible to answer your friend's question to mimic 60-40, to mimic bonds in a less liquid way. I'm not sure I want to try doing it, not to the extent of making it a backbone of a portfolio.
So that makes me think two things. One is that when I was at Morgan Stanley many years ago, I helped manage the Magdalen College Oxford portfolio. So we saw a lot of the challenges. But I guess the real question behind my question on 60-40 is, in this explosion of private assets and now a return to a more normal cost of capital, if you were sitting there with a clean piece of paper, would you be pretty skeptical about how much you wanted to allocate to that space?
Last year was an historically unbelievably bad year for 60-40. It was the kind of year that if you'd looked at the previous 100 years, you would have said it was pretty much impossible for 2022 to happen, for both bonds and stocks to fall as precipitously as they did together. And that even includes 2008, where at least bonds by the end of the year cushioned a little bit of the pain from what happened to stocks. So plainly, there are risks in 60-40. You need to go beyond that rigid way of looking at it. The experience with alternative assets, this is again my probably tending to be too negative or too bearish, but I think the experience so far with alternative assets is actually not that different from classic experience with mutual funds or whatever. There is return chasing. It looks like it's something much more academic and well-reasoned. But in fact, hedge funds boomed in the years before the financial crisis because they actually made money in the years that the dot-com bubble was bursting. The stock-picking hedge funds worked out to pile up on out-of-fashion stocks and short the heck out of dot-coms, and they actually made money during a bear market, which was utterly fantastic and meant far more money went into them than they had capacity to manage. And then they stepped on a rake in 2008 when, apart from a few very famous examples like John Paulson, most of them lost every bit as much money as you'd have lost in your mutual fund. I think something similar may well be afoot with private equity. It's leverage, after all. Leverage has been ludicrously cheap for a long time, and the industry has done a very good job of getting itself to be kept as opaque as it possibly can get away with. Again, private equity, you can come up with all these good arguments for why it should work, and obviously David Swensen exploited that beautifully. But I think there again, you're seeing return chasing, people piling into the sector because it's done well, and that will probably mean that there is more money in there than it can handle, and that will underperform. Similarly, yeah, again, having lived through long-term capital management, there are lots of very sure bets in bond markets, but something can go wrong, as it did. It was not that implausible an event that Russia reneged on its domestic debt in 1998, and that was the domino that led to long-term capital management melting down. That's a point I perhaps should have mentioned in 2018. I think the concept of the black swan has been taken far too far. And any number of things that really aren't black swan events are being dubbed as black swan so people can try to excuse themselves for losing money. Just be worried about all the rather menacing white swans flapping around and be more careful.
Yes, and actually, just before we leave Swensen, I think what is often forgotten is that he did have access to some of the cream of the crop early on, who are not available to many of those who have followed. So there is a skew or a bias that just is forgotten in the excitement.
There's more to David Swensen than first mover advantage, but first mover advantage is a big part of why Yale did as well as it did for as long as it did. He also had very good people around him and really interrogated people looking to pitch him for money. And he also had, similar to Warren Buffett, actually, in the way that there came a time when, if you were a hedge fund or a private equity guy, you wanted Swensen to give you some money because that would look so good and help you raise money from others. So they would offer him preferential terms in the same way that Buffett can often get preferential financing terms in the deals he makes because of his role. It's just, well done. The man, even if his ideas weren't perfect, was something close to a genius. You and I can't do that at home.
Correct. So every day, or nearly every day, you are authoring really typically very interesting, insightful stuff that has people reading your column and your team's work. Tell me a little bit, how do you go about finding the stories you want to cover?
A big part in the morning is about subjecting yourself to the fire hose of information that's out there and trying to survey the territory as quickly as you can. Lots of people send me email. I flick through that anxiously as quickly as I can, and I try to see if any patterns are emerging. I think the Bloomberg terminal, not wanting to sound like I'm plugging my employer, but the Bloomberg terminal is a very useful equalizer. I can quickly go through seeing where different markets have reached. I can see things that are sticking out and follow that a little while and quickly see if there's a clear explanation. Oh my God, what can possibly be moving that stock in that direction? It went ex-dividends. Forget that. But you can use the terminal to scout that way very quickly. I talk to a lot of people. I know who I trust, basically from years of getting to know people and having an idea who is honest and who is smart. I'm very lucky at the moment. I have Isabel Lee, is my current partner in crime, one of the cross-asset team reporters at Bloomberg. She's a Filipina. She's getting on 30 years younger than me. She has a very different perspective. She talks to different people. And that has been very useful for me that helps ensure that I don't become too dependent on the same people with the same groupthink. When it comes to really deciding what I'm going to say, again, one rule of thumb, and this was before I started at Bloomberg, was at the FT, was if you're going to explain something, you have to explain it in your own words. You have to be able to get at why this matters and explain it for yourself. If somebody spins you a tale or you read, somebody has a note that's very interesting, if after about 10 minutes sitting in front of a Bloomberg screen, I can replicate it, I'm confident that A, this isn't just data mining, and B, I understand how it works, and then I can move forward. If somebody spins me a story and I put in all apparently the relevant data into the terminal and I just can't get the picture to look anything like what was spun to me, either it's too highfalutin or it's dishonest, but either way, I don't understand it, and so I'd better not write that, so I'd better not follow that. I do think one of the secrets to my success, such as it is I do try always to start from the principle of, do I understand this? How do I explain this from first principles using logic? And I think when you have the confidence to do that, it does become a lot clearer to people out there. That would be the final stage of making a decision. And then obviously sometimes huge things are going on in the market and you know that you're not really going to be doing deep analysis. You're just going to be doing your best to explain what just happened. And sometimes it's actually more interesting when there isn't all that much happening on the market. Then you can try to have fun, ask where you want to rove the spotlight to.
And how do you judge when you've got it wrong?
Which is quite a lot of the time. Wrong in the sense of making a prediction that is completely negated. That will basically happen with the wisdom of time. If I've actually made a factual mistake, I will know about it very soon because I've got over 100,000 subscribers who get it in their email inbox in the morning, most of whom pretty well inform themselves. So if I've said yields when I meant prices, I will know about it. And it's slipped through the editors, which it's unlikely to do. But when, as inevitably happens, you make some kind of silly absent-minded mistake like that, I will know about it very soon. Unlike with Lex, where you're actually criticizing companies and you really did have to worry about legal matters, they have the money and they have the incentive and they will try to sue you if they possibly can. The field in which I'm writing, at least I don't need to worry about litigiousness. I think the other area that is a new feature in journalistic life since I've been involved is the online lynch mob, which is much more aggressive than it used to be. One of the big benefits of moving from the FT to Bloomberg was that I took my FT following with me, and then I've added a lot more via Bloomberg. So there's a lot of people out there. Comments below the line, Twitter, now known as X, etc. If you say something that people dislike, I was a skeptic about GameStop, and I got immense amounts of abuse about that. If you're skeptical about crypto, but also from a different generation, if you're skeptical about gold and silver in particular, those have come to have almost cultural, political significance. When you're writing about those particular subjects, you're generally very well aware of how much aggression is out there and it does make you tread carefully. I hope it doesn't make me avoid crypto or gold or meme stocks or whatever, but you do know that if you get something wrong on one of those topics, you're going to know about it. And my skin is reasonably thick and my columns rather than me. But no, I do not like being slagged off on social media, neither does anybody else. It's something you do want to avoid.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come, but a quick pause. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time, and he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality. And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches. Let's just talk about financial innovation. You and I have been patrolling the streets of finance for long enough to have seen lots of things, all shiny, new, attractive at various points in time. And it was the late Paul Volcker's aphorism, wasn't it, that the greatest development he'd seen in finance was the cash machine. So in terms of innovation, have you actually seen anything that you would say that's really helped our world?
Amazingly, I was going to give you that exact. He didn't say it was the best. He said it was the only innovation in finance in his career. So that's how Luddite, curmudgeonly Paul Volcker was. In terms of innovation, again, I have issues with it, but I do think index investing, particularly as Jack Bogle, another one of the, just mentioned Paul Volcker, then we get on to Jack Bogle, another one of the phalanx of really great people that I was very privileged to meet while they were alive. I do think that the index fund has made a great deal of difference. It's meant that a lot of people spend less money on fees. It's shaken up the active investment world. That is a great idea. It's not a flawless idea. In terms of other innovations that have really made a difference, it's interesting how many things end up being the same as the last idea. I get into trouble with this, but I don't care. I am a free marketeer. I care about liberty more than I do about most things. But I do think you should save people from shysters out there who are trying to rip them off, because there are a lot of people out there trying to rip people off. One of my first stories, big stories at the FT, was personal pension scandal, late era Thatcher reform, where people were just missold outrageously, if you remember, firefighters, miners, leaving copper-bottom final salary schemes for very charge-heavy index-linked stuff. It was terrible. And I do think, therefore, some degree of paternalism, some degree of helping people through the wilderness does make a lot of sense. I guess the innovation I really think would make a difference, and people are trying to come up with it, but it's still not going to be good, is to replicate the defined benefit pension plan without actually paying for the guarantees, for coming up with something that is close enough to what it offers and the way it behaves through a DB plan that people can treat it the same way. Such plans are very healthy for the body politic and for the economy, and they allow for much longer term thinking. And if they work that well, they also release a lot of people from financial fear. And target dated funds aren't the answer, but they're an attempt at it, and so on. And a lot of the interesting portfolio ideas around improving on 60-40 are similarly trying to get at that idea. That is the innovation I would like to see. But in general, no. I suppose we could also talk about ESG, which is a whole another thing, which is a fascinating development, but I'm not sure it's an innovation that has really been as positive for humanity as the ATM.
So you've written extensively on ESG, so I'm going to think I'm going to let our listeners and watchers go to some of your very good articles that I have read in ahead of this meeting, which talk about, we'll get under the bonnet very well. If you were to offer one sentence on your view of ESG, what might it be?
One sentence on ESG is, there is no particular reason why you shouldn't invest on the basis or taking into account environmental, social, and governance factors. And opposition to it is extremely overdone. But the positive impact that ESG can have is greatly exaggerated. And a lot of any attempts to really do any good with ESG have been vitiated by the way it has been used to try to save the fund management industry.
That's very good. That's one long sentence with seven commas, but very good. Now, culture. You have been one of not that many people to have worked in the UK and therefore seen Europe up close. You're in the US, so you're right there in the thick of it. There's a lot of criticism that's directed at Europe and the UK, because I'm sitting in the UK more of it. Peter Harrison, who's been a guest on the show, CEO of Schroders, quoted in the Sunday Times the other day saying the UK has become a socialist country with a capitalist system. And Emily Holler, who is political editor of Money Week, had a question which is what you think can be done to reverse London's decline.
London's decline as a financial centre?
Yes, and I'm going to add my own in parenthesis, which is it actually just being over-egged because the US has been in a turbocharged super boom, and so these things are cyclical and have a way of sorting themselves out? Close bracket.
On culture, I go back far enough. Margaret Thatcher was still running the UK when I started at the FT, so I've seen a fair amount of different things. Does Europe deserve all its criticism? I get more pragmatic and practical about this as time goes by. You yourself specialized in economic histories. There's more than one good way to run an economy, and there is no perfect way. The post-war welfare state corporatist consensus worked brilliantly in Germany, and to a lesser extent, the other continental European countries for 3-4 decades. And then it ran out of puff. The Thatcher-Reagan, much more libertarian approach worked brilliantly for 2-3 decades and then ran out of puff. And we're searching around for another model that will work reasonably well. But plainly, the German corporatist model is not functioning very well. And the mere fact that there's a real chance people are going to vote for Donald Trump to come back as president next year in this country wouldn't be possible unless people are very unhappy with the way the economy is going here, even though the US has been the home to some remarkable innovation over the last quarter of a century. And even though its stock market is more dominant than ever over the rest of the world. Now, in terms of London coming back as a center, I think the decline of London can be overstated because its previous ascent was overstated. This was one of the things I was at the FT. I was based in New York, but you know, come back 3 or 4 times a year. And in the run-up to the crisis, 2006, 7, 8, people in London thought London had overtaken New York and would talk smugly about that, how I was usefully coming to London to catch up with what was really going on to the heart of things, which was a tad concerning right there. And it was very noticeable that in the US from early 07 onwards, everybody knew there was a crisis on. Didn't know how bad it was going to be, didn't know which banks were going to go bust, all that, but everybody knew there was a crisis. Bulls would admit that this was a serious credit issue that was a huge challenge to the economy, and it would dominate conversations. And London, there was no sense at all that things were in any way difficult. It was quite bizarre. It was like I was going 2 years back in time, or as though these people just weren't plugged in adequately. I can remember all the suggestions that there should be statues of Sarbanes and Oxley outside the London Stock Exchange to commemorate their role in forcing people away from the US. Excitement about the AIM market, which basically never made money for anybody other than the people launching companies in it. The rise of London was overstated in the first place, and plainly in part owed to the Eurozone and the Euro, that it was this very handy place that you could trade with Europe very easily without actually being in the Eurozone. So in terms of bringing it back, note that it is still almost as dominant over foreign exchange trading as it's ever been. And that's a big deal. And that's the one big area which is a problem being based here in New York. For the real genius, the real hardcore of setting of foreign exchange happens on London hours, in London for the most part. That advantage hasn't been lost. In terms of the stock market, that went away a long time ago, and it ain't coming back. In terms of other elements of the financial system, though, you do have the great advantage that there is such a big pool of skilled labor already there, and there is still no clear one place to move to in continental Europe. I've often wondered why Amsterdam isn't building business better. Everybody there speaks English anyway. It's a pleasant place to live. Paris has its issues. People don't want to move to Frankfurt, etc. Dublin is too small. There is no one place that is attracting attention away. 30-odd years ago when I joined at the FT, there was a lot of discussion about London versus Frankfurt. Hard to imagine now. That was the huge thing. The enemy almost was Frankfurt, and the FT was very proud that it had a Frankfurt edition. That was our first foray outside of London, had just launched when I arrived there. There isn't any one single European center. I don't think London boomed as much as it thought it did. And I don't think it has declined or will decline as far as people believe it has. And finally, I'm still the person who worked for the Financial Times for 29 years. Brexit probably wasn't a great idea, and reversing it would probably help London's status as a financial centre. I can't bear to see the country go through what it would require to agree to rejoin the EU. So I'm not necessarily proposing that. But yeah, there are a lot of people who bemoan the decline of London who voted for Brexit, and I don't have much sympathy for them. The importance of Brexit can be hugely overstated, and it is in both directions all the time. But plainly at the margin, if you care about London's status as a financial centre, it would have been better to stay in the EU. Anybody who argues otherwise is just silly. That would have helped.
And actually, I was reading what I think is a really terrific book written by, I think they're both ex-Bloomberg, or maybe still are, commentators, which is The World for Sale, about the world of commodities. I think it is a brilliant read. And I just wonder to myself whether the rebuild of Ukraine, the ongoing redevelopment and development of the world, isn't going to make the supercycling commodities lying ahead quite interesting as an investor, but also where do the metals trading sit? And it isn't in Frankfurt, is it? A lot of it's in London.
It's in the LME still, yes. And although what happened with nickel last year, Javier Blas and Jack Valci wrote that book, both of whom were colleagues at the FT and both of whom preceded me moving on to Bloomberg. That is brilliant. Javier built up his network of contacts within the commodities trading business while he was still at the FT. I actually went to one of the conferences that the FT ran on commodity trading. And it's extraordinary. There are these vastly powerful people who nobody ever hears of and who nobody ever writes about. It was really frightening just to think this is what's going on in the world and I know nothing about it. When I was head of Lex, I spoke to a nameless mining executive. When you do these interviews, you have a PR person at the side. And he gave me anecdotes about various Latin American dictators he'd done deals with to build a railway to his mine. Very Machiavellian, off the record, unfortunately. And then when I asked about another form of mine, he said, well, that's never been profitable. The only time we ever made money was in South Africa, and that was only because we had slave labor there. The PR guy didn't look terribly happy that he had just said that to the head of Lex. But it was off the record, so I'm not telling you who that was. Believe me, there are quite a number of people in the commodities business who might have said such a thing. Getting onto the world of commodity cycles, yes, that's one of the things that I've come to understand better and better as years have gone by, how important that is. Just because it's not directly analogous to OPEC in the 1970s, that told us something, what happened to the world in the 70s. And certainly, you can make a very interesting argument that the world is going to grow a lot because of the move towards battery technology, electric vehicles, anti-climate change. It's a big issue and political issue in this country. Most of the rest of the world thinks they have to get on with it. That's going to lead to some very interesting issues with a very odd array of countries that control the supply of some of those new vital commodities that weren't vital before, cobalt and lithium and manganese. So that's a fascinating topic. And I do think there is every chance that we do have another commodity supercycle taking shape, which is probably good for the emerging world at the margin and not so great for the stock market and for the US relative to the rest.
John, I got a few closing questions, which are, first of all, we rate you, people rate you, you have 100,000 people reading your things every day. Who do you rate? Who do you go to as almost, if you were only going to be reading two or three people, who would it be either reading or listening?
Jason Zweig of the Wall Street Journal is probably my biggest competitor. He writes The Intelligent Investor, which is a take on one of Ben Graham's books. I like the guy immensely. I've been bumping into him for 25 years. I have total respect for the man. He's very, very good. Very calm, came up with one line that I ended up having to copy, which is because I couldn't improve on it. That was his job, proffering investment advice, was basically to write the same thing 50 or 100 times a year and hope the editors didn't realize. And to some extent, that's true. There really is a simple core of things that a responsible investment writer needs to get across. He's now switched to management as Bartleby at The Economist, but Philip Coghlan was probably the single most important mentor in my years at the FT. And I succeeded in writing The Long View. He was Buttonwood, and now he's Bartleby, and I would always trust him. The other critical mentor who I would always trust is Martin Wolf, who has been through a fascinating, fascinating intellectual journey over the years I've known him. And he has moved. He's had the courage and the decency to change his mind and admit that he's changed his mind. People treat him as though he's a London version of Paul Krugman. And he certainly wasn't always that. He often would talk to me to sound off ideas. And that was really a privilege. He came across as very opinionated. I was a little scared of him at first. But in fact, he's a very human person who does learn from experience. Obviously, everybody works for Bloomberg Opinion. And Rob Armstrong, who I actually hired to write for Lex, who took over my old newsletter at the FT. And he is a brilliant guy. That's my list of people you should read or follow.
Fantastic. Now, if you were comparing the culture at the FT and the culture at Bloomberg, what might be either the one word you describe about each of them or the difference between each of them?
They're actually much more similar than I would have thought. Just for context, Bloomberg News started a few months after I started at the FT, at a point when the FT had just celebrated its centenary. The thing they have in common is that they're genuinely global and that they are very much more anxious to get things right than to make any particular point, basically because both of them are totally dependent on people trusting them. I'm not going to talk about this in great detail, but when you get issues like the FT on Brexit or Bloomberg with Michael Bloomberg's presidential candidacy, that is difficult for them simply because it is important to be seen to be honest and impartial. That doesn't mean both sides. It means honest and clear and accurate. It's fascinating how similar they both are. It's also fascinating how global they are. So there's a lot of Americans at the FT, lots of very multinational place. Bloomberg is an extraordinarily global multinational place. If there is a difference between them, and one which makes Bloomberg much more, the thing that Bloomberg does have is scale, and it's well enough managed to use that scale. So the sheer number of reporters who are well-versed at Bloomberg is incredible. In the FT, it was about being a small group of, I hope, very good people, and it's still very good people because it's still a good product, doing their best by their smarts to stay ahead. In Bloomberg, there is this massive resource, this massive reporting machine that I can access. I'm still, after 5 years, learning how best to access it. The sheer number of Bloomberg journalists who have CFA qualifications and MBAs is quite remarkable. So there are far more people, again, because of scale, ultimately because a business model that is working better at the moment than the business model of a legacy newspaper is working. But there are far more people at Bloomberg who'd actually look me in the eye and tell me I'm wrong, which after you've written the Longview column and headed Lex, the FT, the number of people who are going to tell you you're wrong is beginning to get smaller. There's plenty of people at Bloomberg who will tell me I'm wrong, and that's very useful. I think at this point, the big difference between those two organizations is scale and the ability to use it. That was what was most appealing, was that this was the kind of resource that could really help me cover markets, and I will never regret the wonderful years I spent at the FT learning how to be a journalist, but it's been fantastic putting that to work.
The last two questions, John, you've met lots of people on your travels. Who haven't you met yet that you would like to sit down and eat with?
In terms of people I really have not met at all, there really aren't. I've been lucky. I suppose he's still around and he's a very entertaining guy. And it's possible quite a lot of listeners won't recognize the name of Peter Lynch, who was the face of Fidelity, the face of classic mutual fund active management, at a point when it was possible to make much more money that way than it is now, and grew Magellan Fund to be the first $100 billion fund. The success he had cannot be argued away. Something he was doing was quite brilliant, and he got out when he was ahead. He's an interesting guy. There was one press conference where he said a few words, but I've never actually sat down and talked to Peter Lynch, and I'm not sure it's possible to do investing the way he did it and make money anymore. It might still be a very good way for an individual with time on their hands to try to manage money, So maybe Peter Lynch.
He was the man, of course, who said that the most important day of the week for a portfolio manager was Saturday, because then you went out and you asked retailers and people working how their business was. And that was where discovery really happened.
It was fascinating the way he approached things. He looked for ideas in the real world and then looked for investment opportunities to help him make money from what he was seeing, which is nowadays known as thematic investing. And you get 100 stocks and there'll be correlation swaps to help you benefit from this theme or whatever. Back in his day, he just owned stocks. And the other thing he said, which I think was one of the points I did make in my 2018 farewell note from the long view, is know what you own and know why you own it. And I expanded that slightly to know what you know and know what you don't know. If you don't know why you are holding on to something, what are you up to? And I think that feeds to one of the biggest issues with the way passive investing and benchmarking have affected markets, in that 30-odd years ago, people would say they owned a stock or they didn't. Now, because they are benchmarked so tightly against the market, the index, they'll say they're overweight or underweight something. And then that leads to the utter absurdity that if you're underweight, if you're linked to the FTSE, then BP and FTSE and Shell are something like 7% each of the FTSE, whatever the number is, a huge number. If you basically don't think BP is a very good company and you don't want to own it, you're still highly unlikely to just not have any of it at all. You're going to be underweight. So you're in the weird situation where, because you bet against it by being underweight, you want this stock that you own to do badly. And that is a problem. That is the kind of problem that Peter Lynch, straightforward, active investing, long only, didn't run into.
John, the final question. I opened with this fact that you are a classical singer. You performed on stage with some greats. What does singing give you?
Singing in a choir is this wonderful sense of coming together with so many people to make something. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Particularly when it comes to playing in an orchestra in a large concert hall, classical music is much more exciting than people think it is. And it's certainly very exciting when you're in the choir, right behind the timpanis and the brass, and watching the conductor make these hundreds of people in front of him act as one. So that's very exciting. Singing solo, which I don't do that much, but again, it's personal, it's fun. There's this sense of connecting to people. There is a natural human urge. If you go to a football ground, you'll see it easy enough to burst into song. You could also argue there's a natural human urge to dance. I'm a terrible dancer. I'm a pretty good singer. This sense of wanting to release, getting the heart of what's going on inside you out there and sharing it is a deep human emotion and one that I enjoy greatly. So I suppose the other thing, I'm not good at sports, never have been. I happen to have a pretty good voice. It feels good to do something that's different from the rest of what I do, that's not intellectual, but that allows real expression. Anyone out there wants to try singing, you may or may not be lucky enough to have a good enough voice to get as far as I did singing. It's fun. And I think everybody needs something like that in their lives.
John, you've got obviously a great voice, but you've had a great brain and pen, and you have provided investors and other followers of the markets with insights for a long, long time. So keep doing it. Your piece, for those listeners who haven't, Points of Opinion, is really good. And I've been taking it long before we ever connected. So thank you for coming today. I normally summarize some of the salient points that I've tried to absorb. I've written down quite a lot, but I'll just take two. One is that if anybody is listening or knows somebody thinking about journalism, go cut your teeth in emerging markets, because there are the information dislocations, or as you said, you can't rely on the institutions to work as well. So I thought that was very good advice. And a recent point, which is, as we think about our portfolios, what do you own and why do you own it? ... John, thank you for joining us today, and good luck in the future. And it's been great chatting.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.